Welcome back to the Space Biff Spacecast. As ever, I am Dan Thoreau, your best friend, and I am joined by your other best friend. This is a happy young man named Taylor Shuss. Hi, Taylor. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Pretty good. How about yourself?
Oh.
Oh, turned it around on you. Yeah. I want to know how you're doing.
I'm good. I took a nap earlier.
Oh, that sounds good. Oh,
it was really good. My wife got home from optometry school and we had dinner with the kids. And then I just conked out because I was like, you know what? You know who takes a lot of energy? Taylor Shuss.
I hear that often. I hear that regularly. And it's a little worrying, but I try to just tuck in a corner of my mind, not pay it much mind.
First of all, it's going to be super awkward for me to call you Taylor.
You don't have to.
So just so our listeners know, I do know Taylor. I know Shuss. I've never actually called him Taylor. I call him Shuss. I've known Shuss for a little while. We met through a mutual friend and designer, Tim Fowers. And we've had the good opportunity to hang out a couple of times at game design conventions and stuff like that. Shuss is one of my favorite people in the game design hobby, mostly because he's just one of my favorite people. And I was just so delighted that Shuss was willing to come and chat with us today about his board games, specifically a game that he has designed. And Shuss, I was curious, your game that was published just this year or last year. It takes its name from an event that took place on June 28th, 1969.
That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. That event is slipping my mind. Could you explain what happened back in that year?
Sure. So on approximately June 28th, 1969, in New York City, in Greenwich Village, there was a mob run kind of like bar called the Stonewall Inn. I guess it's just Stonewall, but anyway. So it had garbage drinks. You didn't go for the drinks. I'll put it that way. And my understanding is it wasn't actually profitable. The profit they made was in blackmailing people who went there. Is my broad understanding? Yeah. And
I didn't know that.
It was a gay bar, a queer bar, whatever you want to call it. A lot of the more upper class queer people went to other bars. This was like pretty downstream of those. And so this catered to the more lower class queer people of the era. And, you know, New York and in the late 60s and 60s and earlier, especially, wasn't terribly kind to queer people. I know it's shocking. And, you know, there were a lot of raids on these bars. My understanding is the mafia that ran the bar, the mob, they actually got a lot of tips about when they would be raided. They were in contact with the police. It was not super surprising. But apparently on June 28th, 1969, was a little different, and they were not contacted prior to a police raid. And what that means is, I mean, they were shocked, and a lot of the queer youth there, a lot of which were, again, lower class and people of color, they were, you know, all unpleasantly surprised by morals police checking the morals of people. You couldn't wear, I think, more than 3 articles of clothing prescribed to a different gender, whatever that means.
Oh,
yeah. Okay. Yeah. So that meant if you were in drag at like more than 3 pieces, it was too much drag, you know, but the acceptable limit was 2 pieces. I don't even know what that means.
So you could wear like a cool scarf.
Yeah, and like a skirt maybe, but like a normal, like maybe boxers or briefs. Like, I mean, you know, I don't know. And so they were raided and they were putting people in the police caddy. And again, I've read several accounts of this, so the fuzziness is just part of history at this point, is my understanding. But a number of people started saying, "Hey, you know what? This is not cool. This is not right. We're actually going to fight back for once." And so they did. They started throwing objects at the police and being aggressive, very aggressive, to the point that there was, you know, to put it lightly, an altercation between them and the police where they were fighting. And part of it was to show, hey, queer people can fight back too. Screw these guys. And that lasted not only through that night, but the next two nights, and made a number of headlines, most of which were really not putting the queer people in the best light. Although, you know, they did battle back and forth for three whole evenings, which they returned each evening. It's kind of wild to read about. It sounds almost, it sounds hard to believe sometimes when reading just straight up about it. And, and that sparked off kind of the end, to put it lightly, of respectability politics for queer Americans. Prior, the last, 20-ish years had all been like, well, if we showed them how much we respect their rights and how we could be just like them, surely they will respect us back. And I'm not going to say that got them nowhere, but it sure didn't get them far. And so it took some new, younger voices to start propelling the movement in a real direction that would actually take them, a lot closer to where we are today, where it was like, hey, we deserve these human rights, and we're not going to wait around for you just to finally accept it. We're going to get in your way. We're going to annoy the heck out of you. They really pushed the boundaries, for the next, 10, 20, 30, 50, 60 years, right?
Right.
And
so that's, my understanding is this is the turning point in the fight for gay, lesbian, queer rights.
In America, for sure. Yeah, I think that's a fair argument, and I think it's probably true. After reading, I'm kind of the opinion it was going to happen, regardless of the exact details of when and where. Mm. But at the event, there were tons of queer people, and they were all just super fed up with how they'd been treated for the past, 70 years. I mean, a lot of them were teenagers or early 20-somethings, but they just weren't okay with the status quo, so they fought back, and they saw the Black Liberation Movement happening around the same time, and they said, well, if they can do it, maybe we can make something happen. And it wasn't super organized, but yeah, I'd say this was the turning point. There were already a lot of organizations moving in the background that were even doing cross-country stuff.
Sure.
But again, a lot of it was these pickets and suits. That's really cute, and the footage is kind of adorable to watch, but they're just so aggressively respectable. They're so aggressively living within the status quo. And at the end of the day, that's not what really got us past that. I'll put it that way.
So this is the origin of Pride. Is that correct?
Yeah. So Pride every year, is the anniversary of the Stonewall riots, or is more commonly known, the Stonewall Uprising. And that's why it's Pride Month. It's specifically the 28th, 29th, and 30th. But we took over the whole month because deal with it.
Because you can, because BK do crime,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because you can do crime for free during Pride Month and not get arrested. That's what I was, yeah, exactly. Everyone knows that.
You were telling me before the show about some of your crimes that maybe you didn't want on air.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the point is that, at the end of the month, I may or may not fly to the Bahamas. And what are they going to do?
Yeah, they don't care.
Yeah, come on. Boom. Arrest me in the Bahamas while I'm gay? Pfft. Low odds.
So I grew up here in the United States, and sure. I was a very attentive student. I liked history, right? Mm. That's what I've turned into my career. But when I was a student, this is not something that I ever heard about.
Sure. Yeah, that's not surprising.
So where did you hear about this? Now you've turned it into a board game. This monumental event, and that, of course, that's the main thing we're going to talk about today. But where did you hear about this? How did your interest in this get piqued?
When I was younger, I knew that I was not straight. I'll put it that way. And I recall, I'm pretty sure I heard about it in probably high school history as a sentence or two.
Yeah,
probably a very loose oh yeah, this also happened, these movements happened, this is one of them, and then it just never went back to it, because why would they? That's not important, whatever. And I remember this is cool. At the time, I didn't look into it more. I was busy being in high school and being a big nerd and playing more D&D and stuff. But You know, I was aware of it, and over the course of probably the next, you know, handful of years, see a mention to it. Oh yeah, that happened. That was a thing. But my interest, I never looked into it that much. It wasn't until I think it was 2018. So way later, you know, way later, I was working on a game, and it was about like terraforming, and there was a shifting board, and I was trying to retheme it. Right, it was, you know, I didn't love the theme. I actually showed it to you one time, so you actually know the game.
Do I really?
Yeah, oh, it's called. Is tetraforming was I think what I called it.
Is it the one with the polyominoes?
Yeah, it was that game.
And exactly. It kind of like crawls across the.
Yeah, so after table. I cleaned it up after showing it to you, I was showing it at a local event, and I was trying to retheme it. It would eventually become like a game of the Ice Age and like the glacier and yada yada.
Okay, yeah.
But while I was still brainstorming ideas, I was talking with some designers at an event at a local con, and I was thinking, okay, well, what was your brainstorm, right? Maybe it could be about the passing of time. Like, that's kind of an interesting concept, you know, abstractly, right? Sure. Or maybe it's about, like, the Mongol invasion. Like, you know, they moved westward through Europe. I mean, through Asia, then Europe. That would be interesting. And then someone pitched Moses bringing his people out of Egypt. And I was like, man, that's a really cool pitch for a game, actually. But that's not really my story to tell. And then I thought about that some more, and I go, huh, what is my story to tell? What's a game I feel like I might have a unique perspective on or care about that, I mean, I know nothing, you know, I'm not religious in any means, but I sure am sure. Queer. So I thought about it, and I go, oh, maybe that could be an interesting premise for a game. And then I went home and just kind of thought about it for a while. I didn't have any pitch. I had no clue how it would work. I mean, you know, the joke in my head for a bit, and joke is maybe strong, but the pitch that I didn't love, but could see in my mind's eye, was like what I called gay pandemic. And the idea is you play during the Stonewall events, and it's just like pandemic, but you're fighting cops, and it's very gay. And I thought about that for a while, and I went, yeah, I don't know. This it doesn't quite what I want. I want a little more. I just want something else.
Yeah.
And I've had people actually ask me why I didn't make that game. I mean, it sounds fine. It's just not what I wanted to make. Mm-hmm. But what actually did happen was I to finish the whole thought, in June of 2020, early June, maybe just a little before June, like a couple of days, I was on a walk because this was during COVID. And so we were all, you know, masking, and I was on a late night walk. No one's out. And I was thinking about it, and it suddenly hit me. And I'm like, oh, I think I have a reasonable idea for how to pull this off. And then I was like, oh, I think I have a cool idea for a game mechanism. I wonder what it would live with. And I thought about it. I go, well, if you really abstract it, I wonder if it could be about something like Stonewall, like Gay Civil Rights. You know, you're pushing and pulling on these different tracks. You theme it right. You have to do a lot of research, but maybe it could work. And so I went home and I ordered a ton of books and watched a couple things just to get myself started. And so a lot of my preliminary research and a lot of my research was for the game. It was specifically for this game. It was not incidental.
Yeah,
I'm definitely not a historian by any means. But I also knew that I had to do my research early and aggressively, or else the game with three tracks and colors and numbers wasn't going to stick with my playtesters.
Yeah.
So that definitely was a hurdle, and took some time to read a lot about it. But, you know, only researching the first 10 years saved me a lot of time, which I, of course, eventually did the 70s and 80s, which is a lot more time to cover. But that's kind of the broad idea of, like, how I ended up researching the topic, why the game has its heart, has its theme, and yeah, kind of the genesis of what Stonewall Uprising became.
I think it's interesting that you have this game, it has three tracks, and the game is, you pitch it sort of as a blend between deck building and a tug of war, except three tug of wars at the same time. So what are those three tracks? So you've got individual support.
Yeah.
Systemic support. Yeah. What was the third one?
Public support.
Public Support. That's right. So those three tracks, it sounds like they were kind of they were there from the beginning. Were they always set as those things, or had they evolved as you conceptualized it?
So, yeah, I mean, they definitely evolved. In fact, they were the kind of the core of my game's premise, because the mechanism that I thought about when I first had the idea for the game was I really dislike MOBAs. That is, games like a Dota 2, your League of Legends, sure, stuff like that, Smite. I just don't have time for them. They're all really intricate and involved. But what I do love about them is the three-lane structure. I love the idea of the three-lane structure because it means you're never going to be dominating in every lane, and it's really clever from a game design perspective, right?
Yeah.
And I was thinking, what if you had three games of tug-of-war going on at once in this game, in whatever game you have? And that was like the genesis mechanically of Stonewall. And I was like, okay, well, what kind of game would you want it to be? Like, could it be a tile placement or poly, you know, just thinking around. And then eventually I went, oh, well, deck builder would be good because you'd have different suits on the cards and you don't know what order you're going to get them in. So it's kind of spooky. And then you have to build your deck in a way that in theory balances out what tracks you're going to work on. And so the actual details, I kind of fleshed out the more I thought about it. And I knew once I mocked it up in my very fancy Microsoft Paint mockup of the game, because that's how I start a lot of designs, because it's software that I know how to use easily. You know, I thought it was clever to have the sides. You know, at first it was like Pride versus like the cops, but the more I worked on the game, the more it became more like the man, like a broader conceptualization of
sure.
Of the opposition. And then Pride always did the same, because hell yeah, Pride. But the idea that they get different bonuses based on their end of the track, and I eventually realized, oh, of course it has to reset every time you hit one of these bonuses or something. And a lot of the like first month of testing was like getting that system into shape and making it feel good to play. You know, the first like month of work of design work, and this game went by really quick for compared to most games I work on, was me getting the core gameplay and deck building and card play into shape and getting it feeling good. And then afterwards figuring out how to expand that system for more decades, for more moments in history. Cause for the first month, it was just up till 69. The idea is it was to build up to the first Pride Parade. So like Stonewall happens, you know, you win, Pride loses, Stonewall doesn't happen or gets delayed. I mean, I'm very much of the opinion that it would have happened eventually. It was going to happen.
Sure.
But it was getting to a bursting point.
When did that change come that you decided we're not just going to do the 60s, we're also going to add the 70s and 80s? Because I think, to me, that's one of the defining features of the game is, so for those who are listening who maybe don't know the game, is you're playing and you hit a certain point and the cards in the market had been 1960s cards. And then you take those, you get rid of them, and you put out new cards that you can buy for both sides that are now 1970s. And every decade sort of introduces new mechanisms and little wrinkles on what's happening.
Yeah.
So when did that focus change for you?
So it was probably around the end of June 2020. I was feeling really good about the core system, but I could tell the game was missing something, and that something felt like extra content. But I ran it through the ringer with a couple more wider playtest groups to really get some wider opinions and some other people I trust to know. And I kept hearing similar stuff. I kept hearing similar opinions. It'd be nice if there was a bigger card pool. It'd be nice if it shifted from game to game. It'd be nice, etc. Everything pointing at make more cards for the game, let it keep going. And I go, okay, well, you know, I had thought about if I went to the 70s and 80s. The 80s has a really clear thematic and experiential target that you could hit. It's not fun to talk about, but it is definitely right there and very obvious. 70s a lot less so. 70s were a lot more
talking about the AIDS crisis.
Yeah, the AIDS epidemic. Yeah.
Yeah.
And because that's so defining, and in a narrative point of view, you know, it works. It's very sad to say, but it's very much like, okay, Pride is the underdog. This is this horrible crisis going on. And so from like a three act structure, it actually works pretty well narratively. Again, I think that's kind of awful to say. Like, I hate thinking about it that way, but that is sure. That's just kind of how things actually panned out. And if I was going to continue the game from the grassroots 50s and more so 60s throughout the 70s to the 80s, it only felt natural to use it. And it'd also be a disservice not to talk about the AIDS epidemic, because that is what happened to the queer community in the 80s. I mean, there's no arguing that. So, it was just a lot of feedback about how, you know, oh, I want this effect, or oh, I want there to be more cards, or I want the cards to get bigger and bigger. And so, after about a month of testing, I took a break of about a month to, like, think about how I would transition from one to the other. I really, like, just sat down and thought about it, and I got some good pitches, but ultimately I went with something pretty simple, pretty clean, I think. Where players, you know, it's not like a set amount of time or turns. Players kind of collectively make the decision to move on to the next decade to some degree. And I think it worked out for the best, because that's in the market shift. And if the game's going slow, you can buy a bunch of cards. If it's going quick, too bad, you don't get this stuff. And, I think it worked out really well. And it really keeps... You know, it's interesting. It's a really static setup for especially a deck builder. Most deck builders are like, oh, you can get these 100 cards you play with every game.
Yeah.
And in Stonewall, there are, there are new cards every decade. But broadly, their setup is never, ever randomized. It is just a set setup. All the A cards go in the A slot for your side, and the opposite is true for the other side. So, but... Because you just can never buy all those cards in one playthrough, I've never heard anybody tell me it gets stale or it's formulaic or just like solved. And I'm very happy for that, because, you know, a few people definitely said, you're making a deck builder. Why not do the Dominion thing? And I go, Dominion's great, but my game is a weird two-player tug-of-war deck builder. I don't think I need to take all the hallmarks from Vaccarino stuff.
Well, I think one of the reasons it works is because it's a game that in part is about reaction. I was actually in preparation to chat with you earlier today. I asked my friend Adam, who I think you've met, who lives in my basement. And I said, hey, Adam, would you come and play Stonewall Uprising with me like twice? Like, so I can play each side once. And he came up, and one of the things that just kept coming up is the way you've proposed the game kind of works as a series of wagers, right? So if I play a card, I move along the track. I pull that tug of war toward me according to the suit of the card I've played. And according to I move it as far as the number on that card. But eventually, one or the other of us is going to fold. And when a player folds, they have to push one track, one space toward the opponent. But also, now their opponent gets this really powerful boost where any card they play, the number on it doubles. So if previously I had a 3, you know, now I play it and now it shoots along the track and it moves 6. And one of the things that you do with this game that I think is really clever is you're always thinking about not only winning, you're not only thinking about making wins, but you're also thinking about how big of wins they are. And to describe it for our listeners, so the little end zones that you're trying to pull these tracks into, they go past the end zone. So they're kind of like stacked end zones, like 5 end zones. And if I were to pull it barely into my first end zone, maybe I would get a bonus of 1. And we can talk about what the bonuses are, in a minute. But if I pull it another space, now it's a bonus of 2. And if I pull it another space, now it's a bonus of 4. It's ramping up. So as I'm playing, I'm not only trying to get it into the end zone, I'm trying to do little strategic maneuvers like get it just shy of the end zone and then play a really high card to catapult it far into my end zone. But the result is that when I'm doing this, every time I play a card after my opponent has folded, they also get a token, which means their next hand, they get an extra card. So now their next hand, instead of getting 5 cards, they're getting 6, 7, 8 cards, which really gives them a lot of flexibility and dominance on the next hand. And the result is that the game creates this fascinating vacillation between sides. It's sort of a seesaw effect, which means you're always reacting to the moves that your opponents make. And so even if you're playing, 5 times with the same opponent, you're not likely to pick the same cards because you're always reacting to, well, my opponent is really pushing public opinion, and so I need to pick up more public opinion to counter that. Or maybe I need to pick up the other two suits to force my opponent, you know, take advantage of that. They can win in one opinion, but I'm going to push the other two types of public, you know, individual support and systemic support, and just rail them on that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think the card pool really works just because the game has been built to do that. When did you come up with, like, the concept of folding?
Yes, so the concept of folding came out pretty early, and it took a bit to make feel good, but once I got there, it was obvious I had gotten there. And the story's really simple. I knew that I was making a different kind of deck builder. Two-player deck builder about, like, a civil rights movement, already going to be very different. So I just said, okay, well, I'm going to keep the core deck building guidelines. There's cards to buy in a market. I actually really wanted them to be separate, which I obviously kept. And because you don't use the same tools, that'd be ridiculous. And then past that, you know, like, yeah, you shuffle your deck if you can't draw. Really basic stuff. But outside of that, I was like, okay, this has to be I play, you play. This, like, the structure, it's the only way it could work. The folding and buying cards, I realized, okay, there's too many instances of people not wanting to play cards, right? And if you could just pass, you would just pass. You can't pass. Like, that is not an option. No action is, I mean, it'd be funny if the man could do it, because status quo. But gameplay-wise, it doesn't really work. And so what I realized, I'm like, okay, what if the cards you didn't want to play, you used as currency? And so that way, I like the idea, and I wish this was in the rule book, is like, when you play cards, you're using your influence outward, and when you fold, you're using your influence inward, right? It's okay. Kind of how I really like to think about it, because, you know, it is all influence at the end of the day. It just depends how you're going to spend it. Once I realized that, it was just about tuning folding. So there's three steps, like you mentioned, to folding. One of them is pushing a cube, pushing one of the trackers, one space. It's minimal, but boy, does it never feel good. And I wanted to show, you know, you have to cede a little bit of ground. It's never good, but you gotta, because if you could just fold for free, that might be too much. And then the whole doubling and getting cards, you know, that was just me trying out what felt good, what made sense, what was exciting. One of the best things about the game is how it can be really explosive. Typically not so much in the 60s, although on occasion it can. And then in the 70s and 80s, like, learning when and when not to fold is a big skill. It takes time to understand that. And I've won and lost a number of games where me or my opponent just didn't fully grasp, oh, that was the wrong time to fold. Oh, I wasn't reading my opponent well.
Yeah.
And yeah. And so it's, you know, it is an important skill you have to slowly develop over the course of a game or maybe multiple games. And it is, you know, to some degree, it's like, okay, am I reading my opponent? Am I getting lucky? It's always hard to say, but I have definitely, the later you get in the game, the cards only get better. They get higher and higher in value. So like in the 60s, all your deck is ones and twos. And the highest you can really typically get is threes, maybe a four if you're lucky. And then in the 70s, you see, you know, upwards of like five values, you know, you're like, and a four is now easy to buy. And you go, whoa, what's going on? And then you get in the 80s and you see like sixes floating around. And so the later the game goes, the more tense and precarious it gets. And it means that the whole folding system gets, you know, it ratchets up the tension aggressively. So early game, I'm allowing you to make these mistakes. I'm allowing you to get a little risky or get a little cheeky here and there. But as the game gets to its close, I'm telling you, the game's going to end. It might not end how you like it. But you need to be extra cautious because both of you have new tools at your disposal and you cannot know if they have them. And no, I think the whole folding system is kind of what gives that game so much punch mechanically. I mean, the theme obviously does a lot, but gameplay wise, I mean, the whole folding system, I think, worked out great.
So you mentioned that players get new tools in further decades. Probably the big change gameplay wise, not so much thematically, that's the 80s, but the big gameplay change comes in the 70s with the passage of laws and retaliation dice. Do you want to describe those for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, it's funny. At the end of the day, both these function really similarly. I don't like to say that out loud, but mechanically they're both basically landmines. They're just done in very different ways. So the man in the 70s has cards that let them place law tokens, which are two space wide tokens that live on the tracks, on systemic support, public support, and individual support. And so they play a card. It says, put this law token, and there's like a color and a shape, because I'm a generous man who respects and loves my colorblind friends. And they all have an effect. So when a tracker lands on that, and that directly on its two, on one of its two spaces on the board, it'll give you some effect, whether it's draw a card, demoralize a detained person, or remove a card from your deck or discard pile. And then it boomerangs back to your supply, so you have to play a new card. And so they play those little landmines, and then Pride is like, oh gosh, do I go over it? Or maybe they put it behind them so they can pull a card and drag it onto it right away, because they have the ultimate setup payoff. And they can put them anywhere as long as it's open space. And yeah, they can be pretty rough. Setting up those landmines can be pretty tough, especially if you're trying to go for a big play as Pride, and they just get in your way. But in the 70s, Pride gains access to retaliation dice. And retaliation dice are a couple of D4s. They're just like, there's like a handful of D4s. It's so minimal. You know, it doesn't sound that bad. And they play them, and they're kind of Pride's way of doing a similar thing, but in a different way, where they say, hey, if you do this, we will riot, we will protest, we will demonstrate, and be very upset with you. Because when you play one, you put a D4 on a card in the man's market, on a whole spot. It's only six of these spots, so there's not many to maneuver around. And if the man buys that card, they immediately gain that die, or dice, heaven forbid, if you have more than one there, and they then reroll their entire dice pool along with those dice. And so they both function as like weird little landmines, but they're functioning on different vectors, where one is in the market, and so they're saying, if you do this thing at all, which is, I think, reasonably thematic and talking about how the Pride movement and the queer movement at large has reacted and has acted in the past, to say, this is not cool, we won't allow this. And then the man instead puts their thing in the stone or whatever and says, hey, if you go here, we're going to punish you in this specific way. I'm really happy with how those work. And I will note that definitely the 70s mechanics were the most up in the air to like kind of play with what was super gamey about it. And I'm especially happy with retaliation dice. I knew that playing with the market was always going to be like a fun angle if I could pull it off.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like how, it plays out. And it's something that was part of some of the earliest drafts about, trying to interlock the win conditions with deck building. That was something I was always trying to do. And of course I ended up doing that in a very different way, but it was on my mind, the idea of, locking or unlocking cards in someone's market as, relatively new deck building space that I can't really think of many deck builders playing with. And it was me exploring the space, and I'm happy it turned out how it did.
Yeah. And one of the things that I feel like emerges from the game is it has a very solid sense of asymmetry in the way that the factions thematically emerge from their victory conditions. Adam, for instance, earlier today said that was his favorite thing about the game, is just how asymmetric it is and how they interlock and how that works with like the trap cards and stuff. So how do you win? What are those win conditions?
So there's two players in the game, Pride and the Man. The Man's win condition is to first detain and then demoralize 10 people or cards from Pride's deck. They could be any cards. I call all cards in Pride's deck people, to illustrate that the people fighting for these things were real, actual, living and breathing human beings, and not just, not just cards like they are in the game. So, they first have to get them in one zone where they can be saved by Pride and moved around, and then after which they can be demoralized where they're just set forever. Strictly speaking, I could have made those victory points or something else nonsense. But of course I thought that'd be ridiculous, because in a game like this, you need to really let your theme play it up and make sense. And that was, giving the man a win condition in a game like this is almost, it's one of the most feel bad things you can imagine. And so,
yeah,
I just kind of had to pick something and see how it worked. And thankfully I picked mostly right. A lot of the early Man stuff worked pretty well, and I loved, and you'll see this with Pride when I get there, I love how there's the 1-2 step. They have to do it in A, then B order. They have to, because they're rigid. The Man is a rigid structure that works this way. And, you know, it means that you know there's hope, but you also know when things have gone too far, when they've demoralized people. And so keeping that delineation makes it clean and obvious how close they are to winning and stuff like that. And then Pride is a grassroots movement, so they can approach their win condition in either order. There's two ways that they can approach it. A is knocking down the Overton window. The Overton window starts at 30 and they want us to go down. It is a political concept that kind of denotes what the average person, what the average like community maybe is willing to accept politically, yeah, and culturally and socially. And, you know, Pride wants to lower that value. They want to move it down and make it so that it's easier for people to accept them as who they are, their ideals, and what they want, which is acceptance. I know, really wild concept here. And then the second half they can go for, and again, they can do these in either order, unlike the Man, is by gaining a dice. Dice are representative of protests, riots, demonstrations, things like that, things that get a lot of public attention, which is why public support is how you get it. And if they can roll equal to or over the Overton window, they win the game. And so, you know, it's funny, the actual turn-to-turn play, the comment you mentioned by your friend is humorous to me, because turn-to-turn play, the game is very symmetrical. The yeah. game is like humorously symmetrical when you look at a turn-to-turn. Like, I play a card, I move my tracker a couple spaces. I play a card, I move it to the end zone. But once you get to how you win and the end zone abilities, the asymmetry really blossoms out. How the Man is deck thinning Pride cards, and how Pride is rolling all these dice, and the Man doesn't get to have fun, so they don't get to roll dice. It's funny that way. I like to make that joke. Someone like picks the Man, I'm like, oh, do you like to roll dice? I'm like, yeah, I love rolling dice. I'm like, oh, too bad, only Pride gets to roll the dice. Sorry, sounds rough. Yeah. I love the idea that Pride can thematically hit their win con from either angle, because they don't have like that structure set up, and how the Man. You know, they're bad at deck thinning because they're a rigid structure. They can, but they very slowly work toward that and thinning and altering their deck clunkily, and it just gets bloated and huge. Whereas Pride does not have that problem. And likewise, they have to hit their win condition, the Man does, from A then B order. And if A is all empty, they need to go back and refill. Or with Pride, they can just knock the Overton window down further. They have that flexibility that I think thematically immediately makes intuitive sense to players.
Yeah, and you can use that predictability a little bit, right? Because when I was playing against Adam, I was Pride, and he had his tile on the track really close to demoralizing my side. And he could demoralize me for like 4, you know, some insane number. And I knew he was holding that card because he had just bought it the turn before. And I just didn't do anything about it. Because he hadn't arrested any of my people recently. Yeah. And so he plays a card. He thinks he's being super clever. It skyrockets into that end zone. He's like, I get to demoralize. Oh. Because he hadn't gone through the process of first detaining some of my cards in order to demoralize them. And it's fun that you can use that a little bit strategically over the course of gameplay.
Yeah. I will note that in the solo mode, there's this awful rule that I added because I'm a mean person. Where if the Man's bought cards, if they demoralize people and there's not detained people, they first demoralize and then detain all the remainder.
Rude.
Yeah, because I'm like, I don't know if this bot is smart enough to figure this out. So they need the extra they need the extra push to be that much more annoying.
Yeah,
And that rule would never be in the 2-player game because that would be savage. But in a 1-player game, you know.
Yeah. You mentioned that playing the Man is feel bad. And one hesitation I often hear from prospective players of Stonewall Uprising is that they're reluctant to play as the Man, that they feel like that shouldn't be gamified, that maybe that could be mishandled. Sure. So why did you choose to include it, or why do you think that's important that the Man is an option to play as?
Yeah, I hear this pretty often, and part of it, when I hear this question, it makes me typically think, oh, I'm very deep in this discourse and you're not, and that's respectable because of, you know, I think about games all the time, and I'm not saying the other person might not be, but it's, you know, it's just when thinking about political games, like there's a lot that have popped up mainly by like Hollenspiel and stuff, but from other places that have kind of kicked the ball. I would say they got the ball rolling, but the big thing here is it's a couple things. One is that, you know, the man as a concept, as an abstraction, you know, it's easy to hand wave off as like, oh, they're in the minority. We know what we're doing. They're all idiots. But at the end of the day, the people that did these things, that voted for these things, that enacted them, that rallied and held rallies and their own demonstrations and protests, they were all real people. They were all actual factual humans who allegedly, and I find this hard to believe sometimes, but allegedly thought they were doing something good. They thought they were doing something helpful or worthwhile, which, you know, I really can't wrap my head around some days. And some days I look at the news and go, yeah, oh boy. And it's not that I want you to empathize with them and get where they're coming from and feel, you know, feel some sort of comrade. I don't want that at all. Don't do that. Don't ever do that. Not remotely. I just want you to understand as a player, I want you to sit there with the emotions, thinking about how awful what you did is, right? Because there are all the verbs on Pride's side, are all these awesome, positive, uplifting verbs about these cool things you're doing, and you're bringing communities together, and oh my gosh. And this, the man, you are doing just the worst things. I mean, you're detaining, you're demoralizing. Every card you buy is upping the AIDS deaths, which are preventable explicitly. I mean, why would you do this? Why would you hurt a community this way? And what's your end goal? It's not to make the world a better place or to end starvation or homeless. It's not to do anything noble. It's just to stifle a group of people you find annoying and inconvenient. That's all it is. And all Pride wants is just to be seen and accepted by people, which is only a struggle because people like you are fighting against it. And, you know, doing that as a system, like the gay pandemic thing I mentioned, or even as a bot in the game, doesn't hit the same way when there's not a human behind it all. And, you know, thankfully, it's just a game. Thankfully, it's just an abstraction. It's a board game. The other person playing against you is hopefully not an actual bigot who actually wants these things. But the idea of kind of walking players through that and how it escalates and how it elevates everything and ratchets up the tension of how things went in real life only really hit players when you're playing with a real person. And what's always surprising to me is the player who plays as the man is the one who gets hit the hardest. They're the one who tells me, I feel nauseous after playing this. They're the one who tells me, I don't like what I'm doing. I actively want to lose. You know, it's never the Pride player. The Pride player never has those issues because they have noble intentions. They're actually fighting for something worth fighting for. And on the other end, and again, people get shocked when I mention the man is the harder side to play. This is why, because what you're doing, they're all almost objectively all just awful things to do. You know, oh my gosh, there's a war going on. We really shouldn't be doing this. Like, yeah, no shit. Maybe you should think about why people are marching and fighting for their lives when people on your end just dip out when things don't go their way. Because they can just dip out. Whereas people on Pride's end have to stick with the movement because guess what? This is their livelihood. They can't just walk away. So yeah, it's supposed to be uncomfortable to play as the man. It's not supposed to be this happy-go-fun lucky moment like most, like 90%+ of other games, and that's fine. I think you can go play those happy-go-lucky fun games. I love those games too. But games are art, and I think the art needs to be able to explore the uncomfortable bits and make us feel strong emotions. And I've also always been told that good art evokes strong emotions, and I've been told that of my game often. So I feel like that's fine if it's not for you. I'm not going to make you play my game. I mean, maybe I will, but you know, I'm not going to go to your house and force it to happen.
Only during Pride Month.
Yeah, during Pride Month. But you know, thinking about how games can be more than just this, you know, just an enjoyable box of fun, and how they can talk about something else, something bigger. And I see a lot of games make little steps toward this, and even big steps, with more and more regularity. And it's really kind of exciting to watch. as games are kind of coming alive culturally and socially and politically. And it's kind of wild to think my game might be involved in that, to be honest. Hopefully that someone answered your question. I feel like I just started to ramble, but
no,
but it does feel.
No, it does. And this is something that the reason I ask is because your game does a wonderful job of it. And also because it's something I've pushed for a little bit in my work as well, is that you don't need to morally agree with every action you take in your game. In fact, often a game's greatest strengths can arise when you are taking actions that you're exploring a counterfactual. You're doing something that normally you would never do.
Yeah.
To me, that's a lot of the potential of games. That helps us understand maybe the history behind games, the models, the systems that went into a game. Now, I'm not saying that every game does that. I'm not saying that every model is good. There are absolutely bad models out there, right?
Sure.
But to me, there is nothing quite like playing Stonewall Uprising, and the game goes through a turn in its third act. Now, the AIDS track is not hidden. It's there the whole game, but it doesn't come up until you enter the 80s. And then suddenly every card on the man side in the market there, when they purchase them, it adds AIDS deaths. And it has a sobering effect, I've found.
Yeah.
So, for instance, today it was Adam's first time playing this game. And, you know, during the first era, I started as the man because the man is a little more complicated, I think, because you need that A, B process.
Sure.
And so whenever I teach this game, I almost always start as the man. So I had started as the man. And, you know, early on, we're just kind of having fun. It's not too bad. It's light. I'm doing bad things. But when I play a card, I'm like, all right, get in the paddy wagon. And he'll play something. He's like, take that, fascist.
Sure.
You know, we're kind of zinging each other. But once we get to the 80s, then we get quiet. And it's not like I'm going to be like, you know, take that. You introduce an alternate win condition for the man, for instance, where if they let this epidemic just basically wipe out the people they hate, they've won. They've silenced the gay community. And so I start working toward this, and Adam, who tends to not take his games too seriously, he starts getting really like, oh, well, I need to prevent this.
Yeah.
And it creates stakes in a way that I think is important for us to be able to allow of our board games, that it should be able to explore that sort of territory. Now, so you're tackling something really tough there with the 80s. How did you go about doing that sensitively, but also incisively?
So, you know, once I realized the game was going to expand outside of the 60s, I started brainstorming what else I would do. And you know, the 70s took some time to settle on something that I felt that I liked and was pretty clean. The 80s, I feel like I immediately knew how I wanted to approach, because it felt, I mean, I knew the theming of it, that of course had to be about the AIDS epidemic. And then the concept of, you know, the man is the only one who can move this track forward, but both sides have cards that care about how bad it's getting, made perfect sense to me. I wasn't sure if it would work for the game yet. It eventually did. But I knew that made perfect sense because, you know, it's not pride that made it worse broadly. Although, you know, the details are pretty mucky, and I did a lot of reading, which I'll get to in a moment. But, you know, the man is really the side that kind of let things get bad, as you mentioned. So the part of it where trying to make sure that I was doing this incisively and not flippantly, a lot of it was just reading. I was watching documentaries, was reading stuff, and making sure that I was kind of getting the broad strokes. Now, of course, my game is a pretty heavy abstraction. You know, there's no hex and shit map. There's no detailed overview of the Stonewall Inn or anything.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I knew that it could be loose in its strict interpretation of what happened. But, you know, a lot of the reading material that I went through and the band played on is, I mean, it's a journalistic work from like the early 80s to 85 when Rock Hudson dies, released in 87. So it was released in the era. It's actually in the game as a card you can play on the Pride side. Mm-hmm. And it's like a 600 page just beast of a book. And it's just so sobering because it really goes through how basically everyone let down the queer community, even members of the queer community. And the only group that really did things more or less right was pretty much the CDC. pretty much like, hey, this is getting really bad. And the blood banks are like, well, can you prove it's transmitted through blood? And they're like, well, we're like 90% sure. And they go, well, if you can't prove it, then kind of get out of here. And you're like, people will die. And they go, yeah, will they? And kicked him out. And it's pretty bad, because that also happened on the queer end with a lot of the brothel owners. A lot of those owners had local political power and did not use it for the way that they would hope, that I would hope they would use it for. You know, they're like, wow, our business will really go down if we learn there's a sexually transmitted disease that will just kill you. Maybe we just shouldn't inform these people. Even though they were directly told by people like the CDC, hey, this is bad, and your clientele, this is awful for them. And a lot of them chose profit over people. And so just doing that research was sobering. You know, I have some personal family connections to the AIDS epidemic too. I'm sure a lot of us do. It's impacted all of us. I mean, think about vaccines, and you know, the FDA's approval rates went up because of the pressure from a lot of the AIDS groups in the 90s and late 80s. You know, like, AIDS has affected all of our lives in America at minimum, and probably worldwide with a lot of the innovations there. And you know, it's also, and this is something that was commented on by my publisher when I first showed it to Catastrophe, about how, unlike most historical games, my game is in living memory very cleanly. And because of that, it's much more likely to evoke that reaction. If my game, you know, ended with like the Black Plague happening, I don't think anyone would feel so strongly or feel so bad or whatever that analog would be. And because the AIDS epidemic happened so relatively recently and has impacted almost all of our lives in some way or another. Remember, it wasn't just queer people. A lot of sex workers got it too. And a lot of people, you know, especially older people, but many got like blood transfusions. And a lot of the blood companies and blood banks, when it was beginning to trickle out, they were like, oh, well, it's one in a million. I mean, what are the odds? Like, it's not going to happen. And they just weren't testing blood. They just were not. It was ridiculous. And a lot of people died needlessly, queer or otherwise, just because they didn't think it was worth the cost of testing all this blood. And it's kind of awful. You know, reading about it really makes your blood boil, for real. I mean, it's bad. And I think immersing myself in the timeline and what literature I got, you know, really sobers you up, as you mentioned, and makes it hard to take any of this flippantly, because again, these are real people. And then you have cards like the AIDS quilt, which remind you further about the losses and their loved ones trying to preserve their memory, especially as culturally people are like, they're trying to decide, are these people worth worrying about? Like, do I even like queer people? And it's really interesting to see how in the 70s things really exploded, and then the 80s people kind of pulled back because of a lot of conservative wins politically. But with the AIDS epidemic, it just became harder and harder to ignore, especially when Rock Hudson died, because unsurprisingly, a lot of people did not care about the AIDS epidemic until straight people were involved. And Rock Hudson was supposed to be this like manly man who manned all day and manned all night, and he's very straight. And then we learn, oh, maybe he wasn't that straight. And his publicist made sure no one ever knew that, because that would have ruined his career. And essentially, that's, you know, that's a lot of the tipping point. I'm not saying the larger media outlets got terribly better at it, but it's when people started really caring outside of just these queer community groups. And so, yeah, it's supposed to be sobering. It's supposed to be hard to bear through and grit your teeth. And I want the player playing the man to feel just awful, just gut-wrenching as they're doing all this, you know, actively trying to stifle all this and make it as bad as possible to twist the knife. And because that's what happened. That's exactly what happened.
Yeah. You know, I find it interesting that you say that we all have a personal experience with AIDS, HIV. I remember as a kid, one of the first things I ever heard, you know, this is when I was so young, I didn't even know what sexual orientation was, right? I was probably like 5 years old or something. Sure. And I had watched on TV, it was on, I think it was on PBS, and it was like this old Mr. Body program where this guy in like this body suit that shows the internal organs and bones and stuff.
Sure.
That he did an episode on AIDS. And at that time, AIDS could be, you know, you could take the expensive drug cocktail and sort of delay the onset of AIDS. But that was pretty much it at the time. And I was so terrified as a five-year-old that I actually talked to my parents about this. And my dad told me about that he had, my dad is a surgeon, and I was raised in a very, very conservative family.
Sure.
But my dad, despite being very conservative, was always very concerned with his patients. And he had been a medical student and an intern back when HIV/AIDS was still known as GRID.
Oh, yeah.
So gay-related immune deficiency, when, you know, they didn't know why, where it was coming from. They just associated it with the gay community. And a part of my dad's training was that he had people in his medical school cohort who refused to treat gay people.
Yeah.
And in part because they were scared, right? I'm sure they weren't all bigots. Some may have been. But the concern was that they didn't know where this disease was coming from. And so the feeling was, we're going to walk into this room and treat this person and we're going to get it.
Yeah.
Because they had no idea how it was vectoring. And my dad told me that he actually had thought that he might die treating gay patients because they had no idea where this was coming from. But that early in his career, he had made the decision that he had been inspired by one of the attending doctors at his internship who he was. He said, you know, I'm going to, if you're afraid to treat these patients, I will go in. I'm going to help them, even if it might kill me. And it had inspired my dad to, you know what, I don't. And this is his perspective. I don't, you know, I agree with this, but he was like, I don't agree with these people's lifestyle. This may have been their fault even, because we don't know how it's transmitting, but I am going to go in because they deserve treatment. Even if it kills me, this is the oath I've made. This is what a surgeon does.
Sure.
And that's one of my first memories, is as a five-year-old being terrified of the AIDS crisis and hearing from my dad who, you know, for many years, he's changed a lot of his perspectives over the years. He's a big fan of Dr. Fauci. You know, his role in the AIDS crisis.
Sure. Yeah,
but that's one of my first memories, is AIDS as a five-year-old. So even coming from an intensely conservative background, deeply insulated, this was still present in my life.
Yeah, it's pretty wild how, you know, the more I looking into it, I did. And also, again, I started researching the game of June of 2020. So it was very interesting doing all that research. And then I see Dr. Fauci and I'm like, whoa, you're really young here. That's kind of wild. And it's just, it was very jarring to realize his role in the AIDS epidemic. And then to, see his role play out with the COVID stuff. I mean, it was just very jarring, very wild. And then I'm like, oh, well, I understand where you're coming from. I understand where your expertise comes from, which I'm sure most people did not and still probably do not. Most people are hugely surprised when he shows up in the game. And, you know, it is, you know, I know when I learned about it, I was surprised because I'm definitely too young to be very aware of that, at least to have really lived through it all. But it is, you know, it's what happened. I think he is maybe the only straight person that Pride gets to see. Maybe. I think.
Okay. Yeah, sure.
Which I think is kind of funny. I have to admit. It's like, you know, I didn't really plan to put any straight people in there, but fair enough.
Yeah. Well, and the stories that come out of him, that he was very, you know, for an administrator, he was still willing to go in, put on the PPE, and go handle patients. He wasn't That's going huge. To do anything. He wasn't going to ask his doctors to do anything he wasn't willing to do. I do think speaks to a depth of character that I'm glad was represented in some way.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, hearing some of the stories about the AIDS wards and how, yeah, people didn't want to go and nurses didn't want to help for a while. It's just wild to think about. I mean, it's kind of hard to believe, but it definitely happened.
was there ever any thought of pushing the game into the 90s or aughts, or was the 80s always just, we need to end at some point?
Yeah, so that's a lot of it, was we have to end at some point, because at the end of the day, it is a game and it needs to end. And to be quite honest, there's two big reasons. One of them's thematic and one of them is gamey. The gamey end is pretty simple. The game just felt like it ended a good time. You know, it ended, it has three acts and the stakes get higher and higher. How much bigger can the numbers really get without kind of feeling just kind of meaningless after a point? The tracks are only so big, right?
Yeah.
And so from a gameplay perspective, I think there was a really clear and reasonable way to end it. Also, like, when does an event like this really end? I hear that, you know, like, when does the fight for gay civil rights end? Even once they're passed, obviously they're still in flux, as we can see today.
Right.
And
right.
So it's, you know, unfortunate, but it just, it looks like it's not going to be cleanly resolved, like I'd hoped when, like, marriage equality was passed. And I'm like, oh, wow, we might be getting past this. Definitely not the case. Maybe later in my lifetime, but not in the next 10 or 20 years, I find hard to believe. I hope that we'll make positive strides in that time, but I don't know if we're going to finish it and close the book. The harder one to swallow for most people, because most people don't think about this, but it is rough. Thematically, I thought about the 90s and on. My little issue is kind of like, the closer to modern day we get, the harder it is to know about your subjects and how they're looked upon. It's really easy right. to look back at the 60s, 70s, and 80s and be like, oh, this person did all these great things. Of course they should be in the game. But the closer we get to modern day, the easier it is to pick someone who ends up not being that great in the long run. And you can't know that at the time. And that's my little gripe, my like teeny gripe of like, well, I mean, you never know. '90s odds probably easier, but you know, 2010s and on, like, gosh, who knows? But the bigger one is the AIDS epidemic. That opens up a big can of worms in the game, where if I was going to go to the 90s, and this is awful to think about, but it is accurate. You know, the AIDS deaths in the 80s are pretty minimal. When you think about the grand scheme of things in, let's just say, America. And because of that, if I was going to continue the game, I would have to expand that track. It goes from 0 to 15 in the published game. In the joke expansion, not joke, but the expansion, the hypothetical expansion or whatever, a continuation of the game that would go in the 90s, that track would have to go to like 100.
Yeah.
And it just, it's not tenable. It's not, you know, because a lot of that, you know, that like there's still all these pushes in the 90s onward until about the mid 90s is when they started getting actual working, functioning antibiotics, antivirals, anti-autoimmune stuff to get going. And because of that, and because of the way HIV and AIDS works, how it's kind of like we're all in this marathon, but we're all running at different speeds is probably the best way I've ever seen it put, especially pre-antibiotics, pre-any medicine for it. And so because of that, even if it's just preventable deaths, it's just really dour, and it's not conducive to what the game's talking about. The narrative kind of falls to the wayside, because that would be this gigantic other board of just numbers, and ultimately, I don't think it would have served what the game was talking about. So I definitely thought about it. I think, you know, if I was ever to do more content, I would just make a whole new huge group of market cards or something, because then I could put in all these characters I've since learned about and mm-hmm. and be like, hey, mm-hmm. there's these characters that I was either informed of later or read about after we finished art and stuff. I would love to do that, but unfortunately I just don't think the 90s are on the table with the game as is. It's you know, for better or worse, the HIV AIDS epidemic really forces the game to go in one direction, and it kind of has to be its final act, and for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, that makes sense. When the game ends on a great hopeful note, I find this personally a very optimistic game, a very energizing game, this idea that we can push the stone up the hill, so to speak.
Yeah.
So I don't know if moving into the soul-crushing realities of clinical trials, I mean, the game kind of becomes a very slow version of Pandemic after that.
I mean, yeah, the game was always meant to be relatively optimistic. I mean, of course, Pride can lose, and in the rulebook I talk about how that just knocks the movement back a couple years. It doesn't stop it, doesn't extinguish it. I'm not about that. Because, you know, the inevitability is there. And so that was always a big point of view. And I will say, you know, since the game's come out, there definitely have been a lot of twists and turns politically in real life that have not been great. But I am hopeful. It is tough. I understand anyone who's struggling with that. And I do sympathize. It's not easy. I live in California, so I probably have it pretty easy relatively. But even then, it's definitely not always just a walk in the park. And the idea of people in other states and heck, even other countries can be hard to muster, you know, how they're doing. I can hear that. And that's something that I'm just not privy to. And I can only speak to my own experience.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I do think the game is largely optimistic. And, you know, you see the Pride cards and whatnot, and they're all vibrant and colorful and kind of full of life and like almost cartoony, but not so cartoony. I think it takes away from the struggle they're facing. And then you have the man's cards where it's all dour and gray and down to earth, but not in a fun or understanding way, in a way that makes these people look like just the least exciting people to be around. Definitely the losing side. And, you know, like dour is the word I used to describe them. So,
yeah.
And that was very intentional.
Well, and I think it goes a long way toward establishing that you're not the good guys, right? Like,
yeah.
The man does not come across like kind of like the fetishism of fascism, right? Like Hitler got Hugo Boss to design his uniforms.
Yeah.
And so it's easy to see why like stupid teenagers fetishize it.
Yeah.
Because they're like, oh man, well, like you look at World War II, they're the ones who look cool.
Yeah.
But in your game, you're like, we're not going to do that. This isn't fascism, you know, porn. They're just unappealing. Everything is chain link. They're just dark and shadowed, and there's not much fun to them.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, we worked really hard to make sure that we weren't, you know, giving the man role models, and we weren't making them look cool or exciting to be, and all that was thrown into Pride's pool. So, you know, that was all very intentional, and I'm very happy that my publisher was willing to like work with me to make the game my vision for the game.
So now that the game is out, how has the response been?
You know, it's really interesting. Every once in a while, I'll see like a couple like ones and twos ratings, just like with no comment, no nothing on them. But by and large, it sounds like the people who actually take time to actually engage with the game and play it seem to really like it. The people who are willing to seek out these more odd and aware, like socially and politically aware games, they seem really energized by what's going on, and also broadly in gaming. I mean, there's a lot of games like Votes for Women that are coming out and getting a lot of buzz because they're actually talking about something. One of the interesting things about working on a number of games is, you know, I have different like levels of excitement to work on this game or that game. And Stonewall definitely held my attention the entire time. And I was like passionate to work on the game the entire time, which is pretty rare. Even though the game went by relatively quickly at like basically 2 months of hard design work. And I think the reason for that is because it's a real world topic I resonated with and felt strongly about. And the humorous thing is, maybe not humorous, but the thing about it is that it's inspired me to look into other similar topics that I feel strongly about and maybe think about gamifying some of that in a broad way. You know, it doesn't always have to be historical by any means, although that doesn't hurt. And so it's, you know, a lot of my prior games had been more mechanically minded, like the Tetris game you played in the past. But since working on Stonewall, not all, but I'd probably say, maybe at least half, if not 60% of the prototypes I make nowadays tend to be about a specific topic that I feel reasonably strongly about. Some of the issues there is that it inherently requires research, whereas prior you're like, I want to make a push your luck game, and you put some cubes in a bag and shake it up, and you're like, oh cool, I drew the yellow, you know, right, have right, good setting. Right. And then here it's like, oh gosh, like, I have to read all these books about prison abolitionism because, like, if I'm gonna make a game about it, I can't do it wrong. And so it's right. It's weird because if you get it wrong, it's almost worse than just not making the game. And so that's one of the reasons I didn't talk about Stonewall for about a month, is because I wanted to make sure I was doing the theme justice. I wanted to make sure that I felt like I was doing it well and correctly. And, you know, I'll talk about these games, but, you know, a lot of them are in flux at various points because I need to sit down and do proper research. And that takes time and energy. And then to do it right, some abstractions just won't work out. You know, they're not all going to be as slam dunk as Stonewall's was, and I just have to accept that. So it's been a weird shift personally, where prior, you know, I knew about some of these games and I was very interested in them. And the more I work on like Stonewall and the more work I do broadly in the space, the more I'm interested in other games that are doing similar stuff, because I'm just excited to see other people playing in that space and other publishers willing to put that out in the world. That's really cool to me.
So would an example of that be, so I understand that you are co-designing with Joe Schmidt a forthcoming game called Sacred Band, which just from the title, I assume is about the Theban, 150 pairs of homosexual lovers who were the Sacred Band. So can you tell us about that? And first of all, I've got to say, I love it because every historian has opinions and and matchups. And I just think the Spartans are the most overrated military force in all of history. They won like one fight. Anyway, so why don't you tell us about Sacred Band?
Sure. I will note that my co-designer, Joe, would love to hear you say that because he says the exact same things. And our game definitely talks about that in its own way. So Sacred Band is a two-player cooperative game with limited communication. It's about, yes, as you mentioned, the 150 pairs of male lovers from Thebes in ancient Greece, set about between 400 and 350 BCE. And, you know, in the game, it's a two-player deck builder where you have mirrored matching decks. And so you're playing cards and trying to match with pairs is basically the way it works. And so it's very cute because you wanna match up and you get the big bonuses if you do to work together and pull out these cool abilities to beat up whether it's Spartans or Macedonians or what have you to get through your goals. And so yeah, it's been in development for a bit. Joe and I, you know, it's a fully co-op game. It's a lot of development work to make things feel balanced and fair. That's always kind of a pain when you're not fighting a human opponent, which is why most of my games end up being against human opponents, although less and less so recently. And it's been a joy to work on, especially with Joe, my co-designer, who I met because he was there at my pitch for Stonewall who would become my publisher, Catastrophe Games. He was the person playing as the man. He played the game, then said, "I feel nauseous. Tim, the owner of the company, you need to sign this game." And so that's how I met Joe Schmidt. And afterwards, he decided that he needed to work on a game with me. And it just took him a while to realize what that game was going to be. Because when he mentioned Sacred Band, I'd never heard of the Sacred Band. That was something I was totally not on my radar. And then he's like, "Here, Taylor, read this book." And I go, "Sure, Joe, I trust you." And then I read the book. And now we've been working on this game for a while. So, I'm really enamored with a lot of the ideas there present. And again, like, I do like deck builders. That's not the only reason it's a deck builder, I'll mind you. But it's also playing in different space where, you know, your decks are exactly the same stuff, but you're cooperatively trying to play the same cards without, you know, being able to just tell each other what's in your hands. It's really cool. I really like what's going on. And the thematics are great because you definitely get to beat up Spartans all day long. I mean, man, beating up the Spartans is a good time.
It's just the best.
Yeah, and they, you know, the Sacred Band didn't really fumble much, if at all, and they really beat up the Spartans. I mean, that is something that is really funny reading about and hearing about from Joe, who's definitely closer to the historian on our team more so than I. I mean, I've done some reading, but he has done like reading. I mean, it's funny. And I mean, it's just one of his areas of expertise that he excels at. And whereas sometimes I'm reading some historical document, I'm like, God, this is so dry. Gosh. And he just revels in it. And which I find kind of fun. I mean, the balance there is definitely interesting. But no, it's been really a blast to work on. And just working on more like queer games and games in that space, you know, it's really a shame that Joe's not queer. You know, I kind of feel for the guy, but you know, it happens, you know, it happens to the best of us.
Yeah. Don't hold it against me.
I'll try not to, but wait till your wife announces that we are engaged. I mean, what's everyone going to think?
I think she knows. I think she just said that's fine.
Okay. I mean, I need to tell my boyfriend later and see what he thinks, but you know, I'm really excited for our wedding.
Yeah, as long as we rubber stamp this, you know.
Yes.
Although, you know, there is, you know, Shess, I don't know if you know this, there's a lot of speculation that I am gay.
Really?
Yeah, I get asked that a lot.
Is it because you talk openly about queer games and promote them?
Or
is
I
it,
really is it don't for know. Some other reason? I don't know. I've been asked that like 4 times by email. And there was a Twitter account, Is Dan Gay? That was all about like it just kept being like when I do my weekly AMA, ask me anything on social media. Like for a little while every week it was like, are you gay? And I was just kind of like, pass.
Pass.
Yeah, I said ask me anything, not that I would answer everything.
Yeah, well, you're like, that's not one of the games I played this week.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know where that comes from. Maybe it is because I'm playing. That's sad.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's not ideal when that's the bar, when you defending like basic human decency and the art form that you talk about means that, oh, you must be part of that in-group. Yeah, of course. Yeah, that tracks.
Yeah, very, very odd. Well, so is that coming from Whirly?
So Whirligig has openly talked about their interest in signing the game. They have not signed it yet, because Joe and I are still putting a lot of touches on it. So I'm sure that whenever that happens, if that happens, it's not a certainty by any means, people will hear about it online as stuff happens. You know, we're all pretty transparent about this. And that's something I really like. The fact they've talked about it publicly is very cool. And so I'm excited to eventually get that all going, especially because they just announced that they're looking for artists for Molly House, which is another explicitly queer game that they did sign by Joe Kelly. And I'm very excited that having played way back, Joe reached out to me and was like, hey, I heard about the Stonewall game that's coming out. Can we try it? And I go, hey, your Molly House game sounds pretty cool. Can we try it? So we set up a thing. It was great.
Oh,
so.
That's great. I'm jealous. I really want to play Molly House.
Yeah, what I played was very interesting, and I'm really curious how it's developed, because I know it's shifted a lot. I expect it to be like partially recognizable in ways that I'm just kind of jazzed to try out. I really like what Joe does, and I really like what Whirligig does, so I can't imagine. Yeah, it's going to be great.
Well, I'll look forward to that. But even more than that, Shess, I'm looking forward to Sacred Band.
Gosh.
Well, Shess, thank you for chatting with me today. Where can people find you if they're interested in following you or your work?
Well, you can find me on Twitter under Taylor Shess, or my Twitter tag is at Drawn Onward. Which, if you can spell the first half, you can probably spell the back half, because it's a palindrome. Or you could go on BoardGameGeek and, I guess, subscribe to me. I think you can subscribe to people. And then you'll get all the latest news on whatever wacky nonsense I'm up to.
Awesome. Okay, Shess, thank you so much. Take care.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Dan. It was good.